Hello and welcome to Inclusion Unlocked, where we explore the changing equity, diversity and inclusion landscape, bringing you fresh perspectives, lived experiences, practical tips and next practice. I'm Sasha Scott and I'm the founder and CEO of Inclusive Group. We're an equity, diversity and inclusion consultancy in the business of behaviour. Alongside our guests, we'll be exploring some challenging topics, and we'll be focusing on action, looking at what each of us can do, whether we're leaders, HR practitioners or colleagues, to unlock inclusion in our workplace. As we begin to emerge from two incredibly turbulent years, today we'll be exploring the very real issue of trauma and burnout. HR practitioners have spent much of the last 2 years putting the needs of others in front of their own. But what toll has that taken? And what can we do to preserve our physical and mental well-being? I'm delighted to be joined now by psychotherapist and trauma and burnout specialist, Anna Pinkerton. When you and I first started talking, which was probably 4 months ago, I had found you on LinkedIn and I saw that you wrote a book. And I thought, this sounds really fascinating. Can you just tell us a little bit about that book?
Are you talking which one?
The most recent one.
I happen to have a... This is one I made earlier. I'm actually thrilled about this because it feels nice. It's got that kind of moleskin feel to it. This is my second book. I made it an hour read for people that time crunched. It really is... In 28 years, what I found was working with people who had broken down or burned out. So nervous breakdown and burnout is exactly the same thing. We just call it burnout now. And the reason why it was called nervous breakdown is because it's an overwhelm of the nervous system. So in some ways, it was a really good name for it. But of course, like many things, it started to be used in a derogatory manner. So we moved to use burnout, and probably that will change also at some point. This book is really about the nuts and bolts and the depth of what I was finding when people were breaking down. So I started to think, if I reverse engineer everything that I know about helping people recover, but also what brings them to burnout or breakdown, then I can get out into the world and help people not break down in the first place. So what I found was the people that broke down had very high levels of inner brutality, what I call inner brutality. That's their relationship with themselves is bullish, cruel, critical, brutal. So I call it inner brutality. And what I noticed is if I worked one-to-one with these people or teams, and you started to work on incorporating kindness and companionability to self, then actually that internal conflict wasn't keeping people split, but actually it was creating them to be robust and strong because they were integrated. So that's really what this book is about. Okay. It's about helping people understand that concept, because if we don't have that integrated relationship with self, we tend to have a split, a divorce within ourselves, and that leads to brutality. So a more brutality. So the brutality leads to the split. And then once you're split, you've got an internal fight, and it all takes energy. So, you know, if we can preserve energy, then we become more able, we're more resourced.
Right.
I know we're going to touch on later as well.
Yeah. Okay. So that's really interesting. So when we first talked 4 months ago, I came to you and I said, Anna, you know, I think that we as humans need to know more about trauma. And trauma isn't really a conversation we have in corporate workspaces. In fact, in the 21 years I've been doing this job, I've never heard about trauma in a work environment. I've heard around it from a global environment. And I think everyone on the call and and beyond, people who might watch the recording will relate to trauma. But do we talk about trauma at work? And then the other thing I was thinking is, I think we need to, because certainly from a diversity and inclusion perspective, people that are doing DEI roles and HR roles and senior leadership roles are probably dealing with other people's trauma as we sit here in March because of COVID. So hence I want to talk to you. But let's go back a bit, Anna. Anna, can you tell us something about trauma in terms of what trauma is and four types of traumatization?
Yeah. So trauma comes in two main forms, and that's what we call type one and type two. So type one is where there is a very sudden shock that completely overwhelms a person's coping mechanisms, their prior resiliences and resources. It's one sudden thing. Now, you know, keep in mind what's happening in for Russia and Ukraine at the moment, that where, let's say, there was no preparation and a bomb goes off outside my window, that's type one trauma. Okay, now that means there's absolutely no time to prepare. So it's an accident, an assault. No, you didn't see it coming. You couldn't even have half a minute to just get some resolve and kind of brace yourself. Okay, that's type one trauma. And anybody is susceptible to that because we don't know what's happening in our life, you know, externally to us. Type two trauma is what we call anticipated trauma. And we've seen a lot of this, and we're seeing the fallout of COVID now, where there's an anticipated gut deep dread of every day. So when we had the first lockdown, you'll notice people like, oh, right, okay, this is new. I can do this. I know we all thought it was going to be for a few weeks and it was 3 months. But then when it came to the second and the third, our resources were lower. So there's an anticipated dread of every day then. And so in terms of the workplace, what we will find was bullish behavior, for instance, would come under anticipated trauma. Heavy workloads that never relent, that's a way of becoming traumatized. All you need to tip into trauma is that adversity goes on for too long and overwhelms the system. So type two trauma can be a drip drip, what we call a drip drip effect, almost like, oh, you know, I just can't take another thing. And then the other thing happens. And I know we've talked about anticipated trauma before, Sasha, in terms of, you know, looking at what people experience. I know you talk about a lot about the microaggressions and abuses that appear small. But if you have 10,000 of those in a lifetime, they're not small anymore. The brain doesn't care that they're small. Okay. By the way, I can't see the chat box at the moment, but I will come back to it.
Great. Yeah, I'll keep an eye on the chat. But so okay, you lovely. Keep on, because that cumulative impact.
So yeah. Those are the two main types. What's really pertinent to companies and organizations and teams, especially right now, is what we call vicarious trauma. That's where one person's trauma in their body, in their neurological system, if you imagine they're jangly, right, then they unintentionally pass their trauma between themselves and the person next to them. If you can imagine, you know, when you walk into a room and you get that, oh, there's a vibe, you go, oh, something's happened here. I don't know what's happened because it's over, but I can feel it. Vicarious traumatization is like a bit like that. So that really matters to teams. If we know we've got somebody with trauma, or we don't know, but we pick up a sensation. The other way of being traumatized vicariously is seeing and hearing material that's difficult to cope with. Not because you're weak in any way, just because of the sheer amount of it. And that's why that's really important. Like Sasha was saying, it's really important for HR teams. Anybody that really is at the cliff face, if you like, helping people who are traumatized, distressed, have difficult experiences happening. A lot of companies where there are contact centers at the moment having a high level of distressing calls from companies, that's a way of becoming vicariously traumatized, because often it's worsened because you can't do anything to help. So if somebody's saying, I can't pay my bill because it's three times higher than my affordability, you know, the person on the phone is absorbing unintentionally, they can't help it, they're absorbing that stress, and that tips over to trauma for some people.
Okay, so I've got a question, because what that's making me think is, if I'm in an organization, shouldn't my employer be helping protect me more insulation needed, more help? Because if we put on a sort of solutions focused perspective, what can organizations do to help insulate those vulnerable sectors within that group?
The way that I see it, and I don't I don't, well, I'll share with you and see if it's helpful for the for people on the call. It's, again, I go back to that reverse engineering. It's very difficult to do something about something you do not know. Okay. So this is why I say, look, there's reasons, not blame, because we don't want anybody in companies to go, oh, crumbs, how, what do we do? You have to have the information about what trauma is, and then you get to reverse engineer it to see what preventative measures and it sounds a bit bananas, doesn't it? Oh, crumbs, do we have to talk trauma in order to understand it? Well, yes, we do, because otherwise you can't see the pathway to what creates trauma. So if we know, for instance, that bullish behavior actually isn't just difficult and irksome, it's traumatizing, then what we would do is we'd help the person that perhaps has the bullish behavior to understand why they feel the way they do, why they act the way they do, and then they could do something about it. So does that make sense? So if you understand what trauma is, that's why we decided to do this. Oh, somebody's trying to come in. Cool. So for me, it's easy that trauma is my specialism. So I can see trauma, like I can see where it would go. So now, for instance, in terms of self-care, I have to be really considerate, because obviously I purposefully take myself towards trauma because I'm either working in organizations or with individuals that have high levels of trauma. So I have to work really hard to go, what else do I do outside of that particular clinical practice, that walk in the countryside? What do I do to empty that story? How do I try to protect my body from absorbing this? So, you know, in organizations, I share with them what trauma is, how uncertainty becomes adversity and then trauma, okay? Because all you need for it to tip to trauma is long-term adversity. Okay. It doesn't have to be a great big event, right?
Yeah.
It has to be something that wears down somebody's resources. That's why a lot of people are experiencing what we would consider a delayed trauma reaction now, because they've had a very difficult 2 years. They were hoping on hope that they would suddenly feel resourced as restrictions were lifted. And of course, we're exhausted by the last 2 years. Lots of us are not feeling like skipping down the street and resourced.
Yeah. And actually, Anna, I'm seeing, and I want to pick the question up now. Someone's asked a question about type two.
Yes.
And they've said, does trauma from relationship abuse fall into type two?
Absolutely. Yes. So if you're talking about domestic abuse, absolutely. It's you can have both types in domestic abuse, actually. So if for instance, you have an assault experience from your partner, then that would be considered a type one. If you're assaulted numerous times, it becomes type two, but also the coercive control and the manipulation is a type two traumatization. And there's a really unpleasant statistic for women in particular that have been through domestic abuse, and that is 96% of those women end up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Wow. Okay. 96%.
Yeah. I was one of them, by the way. That's the beginning of my book. It describes my experience of 4 years in a relationship with somebody that was very disturbed. I didn't know about it, but at first, but I became traumatized in type two.
Gosh.
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. And it's really very, very important if you think of what organizations are experiencing. And again, in HR teams, if 25% of all women have had an experience of domestic abuse in their lifetime, and 96% of that 25%, end up with post-traumatic stress disorder, that's quite a high level of people in your team or in your organization.
Absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
Again, that's one of those things that's not easily seen often, right? Because there's shame attached to it and embarrassment, etc. So people tend to get very good at hiding the trauma.
Yeah,
Great question.
And actually hiding and covering is something that within inclusion and diversity, we hear a lot about from people within organizations, because obviously that's my frame.
Yeah.
So hiding an element of their diversity, of which trauma is an element of one's diversity potentially. And according to Deloitte, 60% of us cover an element of who we are, which again creates a huge amount of energy to do that. That from a commercial angle, if we could help people be themselves, whatever that looks like, they're more likely to be able to thrive. So Anna, if we drive this back to trauma and people that are asking questions, I see you and we will pick these up and thank you and keep them coming. Anna, can you tell us more about, you know, the trauma workplace today as you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a really big believer, more now than ever was. Obviously, I look at everything through a trauma lens, which might sound quite negative, but actually I find it incredibly enlightening. If I know some of, and I don't know everything, but if I know some of what traumatizes a person and how that person feels about themselves when they're in their neurological disarray, this is not how somebody is thinking. This is neurological disarray. Talking of neurodiversity, when you're, if you're looking at inclusion as a perspective for having people feel who, you know, be themselves in work, then put somebody with post-traumatic stress reaction as well as PTSD, they are in a different neurological state. They are agitated. There's what we call it, their system is active, if you like. That's why, because under the, so we look like we're okay, but under the skin, this is happening. Yeah. And sometimes you can kind of feel that vibe and you're not quite sure, but how do you talk to somebody about it? So really the best way for an organization to heed this or and be able to put practical elements in, make adjustments, is to train their leaders. First and foremost, train their leaders, train their line managers in what trauma is. And I know it sounds kind of scary, mostly, trauma shows up as anxiety, depression, self-sabotage, imposter syndrome, low self-esteem, all of those things we've got the words for. Hardly anybody walks into the workplace and goes, by the way, I'm traumatized today. We don't use that language, but yeah, they might be, you know, crippled with anxiety. Yes. Or self-doubt. You know, what's going on with me? Why can't I heal myself? That's a huge thing in trauma, right? And that question around domestic abuse says, well, it was my fault for being there, so I've created the trauma for myself, which is a misnomer. You cannot create your own trauma, right?
Right.
The whole point of trauma is it's something that overwhelms your system.
So can you tell us more about the neurological state of people in trauma? For people that don't know what that means or looks like, because it could be our colleague, it could be our partner, it could be someone sitting next to me. Can you expand on?
I'll do my best. I'll do my best. So what happens in terms of the brain? You've got a part of the brain, which is called the amygdala. So that's your brain and your brain stems here. So I see it as this little voice. I'm always doing when I'm running workshops. So it's like this little puppet thing. Its job is to interpret threat. Okay. So if you imagine you're walking down the street, it's like, is that threatening behavior over there? Do I need to cross the street? If you're in the workplace, what's the look on that person's face? Are they coming to verbally attack me? Or does that look like a smile? Does that look like it's a friendly approach? So the amygdala is looking. Now in trauma, it's what we call switched on. It's on hyper alert. So the amygdala is already saying, so it's on hyper alert. Now, the problem with it and why what trauma symptoms are about neurologically is that we cannot switch it off as quickly as it was switched on. We have to retrain the brain for safety, like psychological safety, environmental safety, being around compassionate people, in order for the amygdala to decide, okay, I can turn the dial down on this and eventually switch it off. So traumatized people are on hyper alert, i.e. they're looking, where's the threat? Everything's a threat. I can't interpret what is friendly and what is not friendly.
So it's like always on, Always scanning
once,
for
once
danger.
The trauma is tipped in, yeah. Once it's tipped into trauma. And it's that's what some people are experiencing now. They were under-resourced, and you'll find some people are triggered by what's happening in Ukraine because they're already under-resourced after what they've been through in the pandemic. Through no fault of their own, it's just that their space to deal with every day and pressures has been used up with the pandemic. So now they've only got this much space to deal with whatever else is happening in their lives and the world. So that's what we call a trigger.
Yeah.
And I always use the words under-resourced because it's not that they're weak. It's not that they're overly sensitive. They're human. Does somebody want to jump in?
Okay, no. Someone actually is saying, this is fascinating. I have to go, but I am going to watch the recording. So thank you to that person. I've got an amazing question here. Well, I think it's amazing. They're all interesting, but it's a brilliant question. What is the difference between being traumatized and having PTSD? As we're talking about words.
Great question.
Making the words alive and normalizing words. Please, can you answer that? Because I don't know that.
Yeah. Great question. So every single person that's had a difficult experience or long-term adversity, type 1 or type 2 trauma, will have a post-trauma reaction. Now, ordinarily, if we say it on a kind of spectrum, ordinarily, the majority of people will recover within 3 to 6 months. Now, post-traumatic stress disorder is considered a psychiatric condition. It's neurological, it's not personal, it's not anything to do with the person's weakness or inability to deal with stuff, it's neurological. Their system is overwhelmed, the brain switched on to hyper alert, and it's going to take some time for them to get into the recovery trajectory and heal from their experience. Now, that's why PTSD is often not diagnosed until 6 months, right? So if you imagine it like that, if all of us had a very difficult experience, we'd all have a reaction. And what we'd notice then is that we were gathering ourselves and recovering ourselves somewhat in that first 3 to 6 months. Now, those people that end up with disorder is where the brain just cannot recalibrate and recover that quickly. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so everybody has a reaction. Not everybody ends up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay.
Now, the average population in the UK has 3% of the average population has PTSD. Now, I believe that that's going to change. That's going to double, I think, with the pandemic.
Wow.
I would estimate 6 to 10% of the population will end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. That is why it really matters that we pay attention now. Remember, one person in a team of 10 or 5 that's traumatized, that will have a vicarious effect of traumatization on the other people. So it matters for the individual, but it also matters for the group, yeah, to stay well.
I totally see that, because then it almost vibrates through a team.
Yeah.
And you could get lots of people being vicariously affected. So yeah. Anna, we're saying that forget any diversity or microaggressions or any personal history about what my state is today, are we saying that because we're all living through a COVID experience, that to your professional opinion, you think that the numbers of people having PTSD will double population?
I can't see how it won't.
Yeah.
And
sure.
This is why our mental health services are absolutely overwhelmed. And there's also a trauma often has a delayed reaction.
How long? What does that delay look like? Why is it delayed?
It's delayed usually because the human being, if you see the human as an organism, as a whole system, then ordinarily they have to physically mobilize to manage what's happening first, right? Like lots of us have done, yeah?
Yeah.
Throughout the pandemic. And I've just had so much respect for companies that have been through this experience and working day in, day out, and dealing with this uncertainty and this long-term adversity. Now, the reason why there's a delayed reaction is because after, if you like, the aftermath is that then people can, in a way, have an emotional reaction. The system, the organism, can afford the emotional reaction now because they physically mobilize. A bit like why somebody has, it's like, so somebody that has surgery, for instance, they go into hospital for an operation, they have to physically mobilize to get better from the surgery. And then a couple of months later, they have some kind of post-operative blues, or they need to grieve some losses, or actually just process the experience, which means feel it, feel what it was like for that to happen to them. Does that make sense? So we have to mobilize physically first. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, got it. Makes perfect sense.
Somebody's running after us on the street. We leg it, right?
Yeah.
We get out of there.
Yeah.
And then after the shock and the fear and the emotion then hits us. So it's like that, but on a grand scale.
Okay. Brilliant. So then, Anna, and this is picking up on a question, on the note of delayed trauma, do you remember when you and I did our taster video? We talked then, or you talked about mobilization and then going through trauma and then the recovery experience and then healing. So yeah. This person is asking a brilliant question, which is, what's the difference between recovery and healing?
Great question. I make a distinction here. So recovery means truly what it says, to recover oneself, to kind of pick oneself up and feel more like you. Now, the healing experience, and I do think that these need to be separated, is where you become more you, more whole after your adversity, your difficult experience, your overwhelming experience. You recover yourself, you can eat, you can sleep, you can socialize again, you can work, you can settle to task. But the healing is where you have to learn to become flexible with the experience. So how do you integrate something that was shocking? Like for me, my trauma was so overwhelming that I hit rock bottom with such vengeance that I had to recover myself for 2 years to feel in any way like me again. And then I was on the healing trajectory. And some people would say, perhaps you're always healing from trauma for all of your life, because you're learning to live with it in a different way as you grow, as you evolve, as you get older. Yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting. And thank you for your honesty, Anna. Just moving slightly back into the kind of work environment.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've just seen another really interesting question. This interaction is brilliant, by the way, everybody. But my work question is, how can we help people if we identify their trauma? What practical things can you and I do, anyone on this call, HR or not HR, colleague to colleague, what can we do to help others? And then what can we do to help ourselves?
Great question. Okay, so without being too prescriptive, but for the sake of this, I'll try to narrow it down. What I've found over the last 28 years is that people in trauma have two main issues. One is that they hold it against themselves, that they can't recover themselves. So their inner brutality, which is why I write about it in the book, they fall out with themselves. For goodness sake, not only did I have the trauma, not only did I have the experience, but now I can't get myself better. So I'm stupid, I'm weak, and blah, blah, blah. Now, that's because the brain gets mixed up between being weakened by the experience, and then it interprets it as being weak, because we love polarizing things, don't we? It, particularly in the UK, you're either strong or you're weak, and of course it actually matters not really what somebody is. I'm just a big believer in it's not sexy to us to go I'm weak. You know, I'm weak at certain things. Do I care? No, I've moved on. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, it's because we put value judgments on ourselves and other people, but mostly for ourselves, right?
Absolutely. Those words that are so poisonous, should and must. should and must. Yeah. I think they should be banned from the English language. Yeah. But for anyone on the call, listen to the inner voice. And when it's saying you should and you must, maybe answer back. Just saying. Sorry, Anna, I'm intervening.
It's great. You know, that's exactly the work that I do with people in leadership roles, is because their inner narrative will affect people around them. It's the most significant effect they'll ever have. So do that work on that internal narrative is so important. So people that are traumatized, they have this high level of inner brutality often because they can't get themselves better up because they happen to be human. The other thing is, when people don't have what I call a full emotional palate, they will struggle to get into the recovery trajectory. And that's because, through no fault of their own, they've got three or four emotions that they're okay with, and then another six or seven that really that they find abhorrent or not easy. Okay, now that happens to us all. We all come out of our childhoods and early adulthoods with a certain emotional template. So when people are traumatized, they often are trying to get through the trauma and into recovery without having all of their emotions. So one crucial thing that I've been doing with companies is helping people understand the concept of a full emotional palette. If you've got a boss that doesn't have a full emotional palette, they can struggle to empathize with somebody that's got more than they have. So if you've got a boss that's keen on happy, joy, and anger, but the other seven emotions aren't available to them, they're really going to struggle to empathize. They can't feel it with that other person. Yeah, but it's quite easy. Just go and go, right, let's have a feel into what this, what's in a full palette. What do you find tricky? No judgment. We've all got a template. Find out what's missing. Give them some more resources, i.e. Extend their emotional palette. They'll have more empathy. They'll see it and they'll feel it with others. Not for them, not instead of them, but with them alongside them in solidarity. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's really important. Those are the two key things in trauma. Somebody's asking another question.
Yeah, so they're saying, do you think that's because they don't want to recognize certain emotions or because they can't recognize? And that question implies a choice, which is interesting.
Good question. I mean, usually it's not purposeful. Okay. We're all spewed out of our childhoods with a template that looks a bit like our parents or our caregivers or significant people around us. So it's nobody's fault, and we just get used to it. Like, I came from a family where pride was bad, right? So when I got a first class degree, I took the call. I'd moved from Leeds to London, took the call. I was like, oh, thank you. Move on.
Wow. Is that shame as well? I can't be pride. I can't demonstrate pride. Is there shame that stops that, do you think?
Most likely, because we easily mix up where somebody's pride in self looks like arrogance, but actually it's never actually arrogance. Arrogance is arrogance, and it's a defense mechanism because somebody feels fragile, right? That's what arrogance is. It's covering a fragility. So even if, you know, if you see somebody that's got arrogant behavior, they're not arrogant people. They're hurting and they're fragile inside. Same with bullying behavior.
Yeah. So interesting.
That's kind of off piece, isn't it?
But slightly off piece. And I want to stay on piece, although, you know, frankly, I think we should be doing a series here rather than just a one-off. But I want to go back to, so what can I take away from this session today? How can I help my colleagues? How do I identify it in others? And what can I do to help them? And what can I do to help me?
Well, actually, interestingly, when you were saying about answering your internal voice, that's one of the things we can all do quite privately, actually. The more okay we become with who we are and who we're not, right? You know, I'm not a famous model. I'm not a famous celebrity, so what? You know what I mean? So you have to be okay with who you are and also who you're not, because otherwise that internal conflict gets all in the way, uses up energy, you never feel good enough, you're looking for perfection, which doesn't exist, and you know, in your brain creates you to look at the deficit in yourself all the time. So So I know that that sounds almost perceptual, but this is very practical. Becoming more okay with who you are and who you're not is probably the biggest thing you can do to affect the world for the better. It masses, you know, I work with leaders of organizations and teams, and this is the work that I do with them, because this is the work that makes the difference. You know, they can go and get a resilience training off a shelf, but if they've got a high level of inner brutality, or they're internally split and fighting themselves, going, I want to love doing the 60-hour week. I want to love doing the 60-hour week. I want to love feeling exhausted. Well, you're never going to get there, right? You're never going to integrate and be okay with yourself, because you're asking yourself to do something you can't do. So this is very practical in that way. Become more okay with who you are and who you're not. And therefore, you will become more okay with people that have an opposite emotional palette to you. You'll have more empathy for where they're coming from. You'll meet them with solidarity, right? And not brutality. It doesn't mean to say this is not like skipping down the street, fluffy stuff. This is really tough work. So I'm just working on an article. I'm making myself laugh, actually, because I'm just working on an article that's called Kindness in Leadership. It's Tough, Not Fluff.
Great title.
That's the title of it. Because when I work with individuals clinically in this way, right, we're looking at rewiring how their brains have been put together, in a sense. They're flabbergasted about how simple the formula is, I guess, in a complicated situation. We're complicated as human beings, and you know, and it's tough work. You know, it's tough work to drop into oneself and meet and treat yourself differently. But the better you meet and treat you, the better you'll meet and treat, and more effective you will be.
What we're saying, Anna, here is that the really important work around trauma and around inclusion and diversity starts with self.
Self.
Starts with deep, deep work on self. So what this makes me think, Anna, with my commercial hat on, is there is a real urgency for more coaching within organizations around trauma and leadership behaviors, colleague behaviors, but trauma as well. Yeah, if you coached me on how I could manage my trauma, I'm going to be a better colleague, human being, happier, balanced.
Well, I think you've made a good point. It's reaching the human being, not the behavior. Now, we're very behavior focused, and rightly so, but trauma, people that are behaving badly in somebody's mind, that if they're behaving in a way that brutally impacts another human being, that person has trauma themselves. So you have to try to reach the person in there, because they're often trying to do something they can't do. Again, that's another reason why organizations should be more trauma informed, because you've got to be careful when you're asking your working population who are traumatized, i.e. neurologically in disarray, to do something they can't do, right? So it doesn't help to keep loading them. It doesn't help to raise your voice at them, because their system is traumatized, but you can reach them. And talking about it, interestingly, because I mean, I was a psychotherapist for years, and I mean, I used to think, well, how does this even work? And yeah, what we know about it is it works because when we talk something through, we talk it over. And if you think about what that sentence actually means, we talk it over, i.e. by talking about it, the human brain decides that that's in the past tense. It puts it in the memory banks. Now, for traumatized people, it's right up front. So even if that thing happened 10 years ago, the brain thinks, right, the trauma happened now. So when we talk things over in a therapeutically coaching way, then what that means is they truly talk it until it's over for them.
Okay, I've got Anna. I'm now feeling a little stressed because we've got 5 minutes, and honestly, the questions are flooding in, which is amazing. Right, here's a fascinating question. Can you explain, Anna, why one person who has lived a traumatic event may have no trauma or PTSD, and another person, exact same event, can have trauma or lifelong PTSD?
Yeah, great question. Great question. Again, this is no judgment, okay? There is no value judgment when we're looking at anything in life, really, because it doesn't help. Now, what happens is you'll have somebody, for whatever reason, will have a prior resilience or prior resource through, they didn't really necessarily do anything to make that happen. It might be that they came out of childhood with a full emotional palette and they feel at ease processing, i.e. feeling their emotions and getting through them, yeah?
Yeah.
It might be that they have a particular type of intellect where they can view and talk themselves through the experience. Now, people that are vulnerable to post-trauma reactions and PTSD either have prior trauma, they don't have a full emotional palette through no fault of their own. They might have other, what we call pre-morbid, it's a horrible word of saying, let's say pre-trauma conditions, experiences that create fragilities. Again, they're at the mercy of the world and their experiences. So when these same people have the same experience of trauma, it really matters what predated it, what the internal template is, and also like attitudes to talking things through. Right.
So culture will affect this, upbringing will affect this, and age, which is this why we're seeing an explosion of mental health problems with younger generations and people transitioning into the workplace now and kids at school because they don't have a fully formed emotional palette?
Yeah. Well, they're forming them. So there's a vulnerability because of their developmental stage. Like teenage, the speed of development in teenagers is exactly the speed that a toddler. So a toddler is learning to hold themselves standing, walking, interpreting the world, friend, foe, and the speed of that happens in adolescence as well. So if you imagine an adolescent is growing through the speedy developmental phase and they have trauma, boom. That's why people often feel thrown backwards.
Okay. Wow, this is really fascinating. So Anna, we're down to our last 3 minutes, and I'm mindful that if you've got any questions, please do pump them into the chat. Let's just think about a couple of things that people can take away to help them look after themselves, or top tips. I'm going to ask you, Anna, some top tips to take away.
I'll see if I can get some. when I was thinking about this, I think it's really important. So again, we go back to self-development, self-knowledge. That always helps. And that doesn't need to be like, let's dig it all up and look at all our childhood. It looks at just who am I and who am I not? And how do I look after my limit? We all have a limit, whether we like it or not, because we happen to be human. Yeah. So without exception, everybody has a limit. And we are often unable to change that. So we have to become okay with what our limit is. I don't have oodles of energy, right? I have to pace myself. So I look a bit like a control freak in some ways, because although I have a VA, she doesn't deal with my diary because I have to look after where my energy goes. Yeah. So that's really important. And actually, that question around what would make somebody vulnerable to trauma would be somebody that's already living at their bandwidth too often.
Right. The executive, the high flyers that some of us meet day in, day out. Yeah.
So they look incredibly resourced because they can do a 60, 70 hour week. But actually, if something else comes along, there's a fragility there. It's not their fault. They've got the evidences that they can manage a 60-hour week in, week out, just about. But you can't get a wafer thin mint in there, or and they can't deal with anything else.
Wow.
So again, stay within your limits. You stay more resourced. Yeah. And also the there is no work-life balance. That's an utter nonsense. There is such a thing as balancing and it's continuous and it's always happening. So you'll never get balance. So if you imagine it as a dynamic thing, and also life is life. You're wherever you're living it, in work or home. So yeah. It's always adjusting. That's okay. Another really useful way of staying well.
For anyone listening who wants to explore the issues of trauma and burnout in your own organisation, whether that's with your leadership team, line managers or HR teams, or maybe just as an individual, please follow the link on the landing page for this episode, where you can find out more about the trauma and burnout session that Anna runs with us at Inclusive Group. We'd love to hear from all of you on if this topic is of interest. And so now, all that leaves me to do is share a very huge thank you to Anna, and thank you to everyone who's tuned in today.